Hey there. Welcome back to Model Minority, Uniquely American. I'm Nidhi Shastri. In the last episode, we explored how people who are native or bilingual speakers of their mother languages feel about their native tongue. We heard ways in which language access can both enhance your life and also ways in which it can make things much, much harder. Now, in the second half of On Loving and Losing Our Tongues, we are hearing from folks who don't speak their native language, or those who do, but are barely able to hold on to it or to pass it down. I do strongly suggest that if you haven't already listened to part one, definitely go check that out. It's called On Loving Our Language, and although it's not a requirement for this episode, it definitely helps to add context. So today, we're hearing from diaspora whose roots lie in African countries, Asian countries, Middle Eastern countries, and even from people who can't trace their home to any one spot on a map. A quick thank you to everybody who sent in a clip. I really appreciate you lending me your voice. And also thanks to you, yes you, who's listening right now, for tuning in to the second half of On Loving and Losing Our Tongues from Model Minority, Uniquely American. I feel that being unable to speak your native language comes not only with a lot of practical challenges, such as difficulty in understanding or communicating with your family and others from your ethnicity, but also sometimes comes with a bit of mental turmoil. I mean, who of us that comes from a bilingual background, whether we speak our native language or not, hasn't been made fun of by our own for messing up our grammar or using an incorrect word, or worse, just blatantly being unable to speak our native language? And there's a plethora of nicknames that comes along with this, be it coconut or Oreo or whatever other politically incorrect yet somewhat humorous and pretty stinging words that our friends or families back home would use to describe us as quote-unquote whitewashed diaspora kids. But for people who don't speak their native language at all, it's often not by choice. In our last episode, we covered the myth of bilingualism, which is this concept that gained hold in the United States in the 80s and the 90s, and even still today, that if parents teach their children two languages or more while they're growing up, say for example both Korean and English, that then their English would greatly suffer. In 2023, we know that's not true. I mean, my first language was Gujarati, and you tell me, how does my English sound? Yet this myth deterred, understandably, a lot of parents from passing down their native tongues. And the turmoil that comes with that not only impacts our parents through feelings of deep regret and sadness over this language barrier between them and their parents and their children, but it could also manifest in a resentment from diaspora kids towards our parents, especially if now as an adult or even a teenager, you just aren't fluent enough to get by. And the heartbreaking part of it is that it's neither of their faults, is it? It's something that immigrants were told to fear when they moved to the United States, and for their kids, it's not easy to learn your native language as an adult, especially since many of our languages from model minority countries don't use Latin grammar or alphabets as English or Spanish or French do. Even the written text is oftentimes completely different. And so, this myth has made it tenfold harder for that cultural access in our communities to be passed down again once it's lost. So, it's not often easy to define the role that language plays in people's lives, especially if you only speak one language. And so, what I found was that for many of the people in the clips that we're about to listen to, they describe less what language means to them and more about what meaning they feel they're losing or missing by not being bilingual in their native tongue. So keep an ear out for that theme as you listen, how monolingual people are actually working through the meaning of language, and in some of these clips, you can actually hear people thinking through it. So I'll start with a friend of mine, Abhinav Das, who grew up in the Middle East, but only speaks one language, English. He described very well this duality that immigrants who only speak English are faced with.
What does language mean to me? So I actually thought that this was a little difficult to answer at first, since I don't speak my mother tongue, I grew up away from my home country, and English is the only language I can speak fluently. But then I thought about it some more, and I realized that language actually means a great deal to me. I mean, I love reading, I love stories, and I love connecting with other people. But My parents have often told me that I'm missing out on so much just by only speaking one language. They've told me that their mother tongue, Bengali, conveys a sense of friendliness and affection that they just don't see in other languages. And they say that they can express a lot of things in Bengali that they cannot in English. For instance, when they see a doctor, they can describe their physical symptoms with a depth and precision that is just impossible in the English language. Very often, my friends and colleagues also tell me about their favorite books that have never been translated into English. And sometimes that makes me feel like there are whole universes out there that I just haven't been able to explore. It's sometimes also a little harder to connect with people who share the same background as me because I don't speak the same language. But it definitely doesn't always have to be that way. Many of my closest friends, like me, are Asians who grew up abroad, and I feel like we share so much in common, like so many common values and just, little things, even without speaking our mother tongue.
What's super interesting to me about Abby's story, and a bit unique too, is that Abby has a very audible non-American accent. And so the implication is oftentimes that he's bilingual, especially because he's an immigrant. Even when I first met him, I think I most likely had made the automatic assumption that he's bilingual or even that English might be his second language. And yet, that's far from the truth. It's a layer that we don't often think about regarding accents. What preconceived biases take over when an American English speaker first meets somebody with an accent, regardless of if they're bilingual or not? As you can probably tell from that voice note, Abby's a really eloquent speaker, and he definitely has a better grasp on English than I do. And yet, his situation of being an immigrant from a non-Western country yet speaking English is actually not as rare as you'd think. According to the CIA's website, I know, I don't like the CIA either, but according to the CIA's World Factbook, at least 64 different countries in the world have English as one of their listed official languages. Included in that number are countries like Nigeria, Barbados, Guyana, Ghana, Hong Kong, India and Pakistan, Kenya, the Philippines, South Africa, Somalia, Sudan, Singapore. I could go on and on, but you get the idea. So many of these countries, as we know, are former British colonies, and one effort from the British was to drive out the quote-unquote barbaric native languages and instill English instead. The British went so far as to make it illegal to speak the native language in some places and enforced English on signage and in schools countrywide. In fact, it's part of Rudyard Kipling's racist philosophical poem titled The White Man's Burden, published in 1899, centered around the Filipino-American War. This is the same Rudyard Kipling who wrote The Jungle Book. So if you didn't know he was a racist before, well, now you know. Kipling's piece was a love letter to American imperialism, and perhaps the most notable theme within it was that white people and European countries have a quote-unquote duty, a burden even, to seize and civilize non-Western brown and black parts of the world, the quote-unquote barbaric third-class countries that have no technology, and he went so far as to describe these groups, I quote, as half devil and half child. This concept, the white man's burden, was used to justify and even promote the colonization of several non-Western countries by the British and other white powers. Some people argue that the piece was written as satire, but even so, it was used as an argument to justify a whole lot of genocide and other terrible things. And if you were to look at, say, countries like Trinidad and British Guyana and South Africa, you would see right away that these countries have an extremely high demographic of South Asians who are English speakers. This is because of the British slave trade under colonization, a lesser known but equally evil slave trade of Indians and other South Asians during the British Raj. And for those folks whose identities have shifted with the generations of families who now call countries in South America and in Africa their home, it's difficult for people to understand why they eat desi food like biryani and practice common South Asian religions such as Islam and Hinduism, but through generations and generations are solely English speakers, and furthermore, in some locations, often have a heavy Caribbean accent. There are traditions and things that these families have held onto and fought to pass down. Their stories are a combination of colonization, forced language erosion, and the resilience of people to hold on to words and foods and songs and native themes and native languages woven into their new culture, despite at no fault of their own, overwhelmingly passing down and speaking fusions of English that wrapped South Asian languages as well as South American ones and African forms of English all together. This is true as well for communities like the Romani people in Europe, who are also of South Asian descent. Imagine how difficult it is when you've been taken from your home and dropped into another country by colonists who consider you and your family their property. These are honestly some of the most heartbreaking yet resilient stories in our community, and I do think that many of us South Asians who are first generation with parents who came directly from South Asian countries have a lot to learn and a lot to owe to Indo-Caribbean communities for their cultural fusions that we can now take part in the United States. So, we know that language is a big part of identity. Even if you're a native English speaker primarily, your accent even plays a role in who you are. And that's often entangled with your nationality and your ethnicity, though not always. I had the privilege to speak to Zamzam Dini, a therapist and a researcher whose work centers around immigrants and refugees. She's published research exploring how language plays a role in therapy and in trauma. I actually released an Immigrant Tales episode featuring Zamzam's story of how her family first came to the United States from Somalia earlier this year, so definitely go check that out when you can. It's only about 8 minutes long, and it's a really, really moving story. But today, we'll be hearing from Zamzam throughout the episode on her research and what it means for us and understanding language loss over generations.
My name is Zamzam Dini. I am a licensed associate marriage and family therapist and a third-year doctoral student at the University of Minnesota in the Department of Family Social Science, and I specialize in couple and family therapy. So I speak Somali, and my mom's primary language is Somali, but when I interact with my siblings, our primary language is English. And then I have a 13-year-old nephew whose primary language is probably English. And so we always make fun of him, but there is definitely like a struggle between conversations between him and his grandmother. And it also kind of scares me because he engages with our grandmother a lot, but then you'll catch him using English grammar for Somali words. And so it's really funny. Growing up, I remember this talk about like, we can't have children learning more than one language. It's going to confuse them. But then now, like in this maybe last decade or so, you see a lot of language immersion schools popping up because people are realizing, like the researchers are realizing, like when you are bilingual or multilingual, your brain develops and expands better. And actually having two languages is biologically better. So you have, you know, wealthy white middle-class families who are putting their children in language Spanish, you know, immersion programs. And then you have the immigrants who need those language immersion programs that are still being sort of left out from these resources. Even I know a lot of people whose parents assimilated to the point where they don't speak their native language, and they have a lot of guilt and regret around that, and because language is deeply, deeply connected to identity, wishing to have another language to speak and holding on to that part of their culture.
What Zamzam brought up here about immersion schools and bilingualism is so interesting. One theme I saw in a number of clips you all sent in to me was how many people who grew up in the United States whose parents are from Asian, African, Middle Eastern countries are in fact bilingual. Only, instead of being able to speak their native tongue like their parents do, they're actually bilingual in Spanish. Often, Spanish is a language that they learn in school, and in some places in the United States, it's even a requirement in order to graduate. And as Zamzam mentioned, that allows for a number of practical applications and opportunities to help other immigrant groups, which actually builds solidarity. So, ultimately, being bilingual in Spanish or any other language is a good thing. But what also comes with this is the reality that folks can sometimes connect more deeply with Spanish-speaking communities than with their own religious and cultural communities, and in some cases, better than even with their own families.
Hello, my name is Shukri, and I am a Palestinian American and Muslim. As an Arab American whose majority upbringing was in Illinois suburbs, I am a product of bilingualism, but to some people's surprise, my second language is Spanish. And while it is a great asset to have in a pharmacy setting, I feel like I could have spent my youth also learning Arabic, which could have been easier to help me connect with my religion, such as reading the Quran, connecting with the Arab community, and bonding with my relatives who exclusively spoke Arabic, such as my Siddi, Allah yarhamah. But the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago, and the second best time is now.
It is really hard to pick up a second language as an adult. According to an article published in Time magazine in 2018 titled, "Why It's So Hard to Learn Another Language After Childhood," our ability to pick up a second language tends to decline after the age of 18. This isn't necessarily because our brains aren't strong enough or we can't pick up information as well as when we were a child. It's actually due to a couple different factors, such as an increased risk of making mistakes and being vulnerable, and a decline in free time and time management. So, as anyone who's picked up Duolingo as a fun activity but ended up super stressed out knows, it is hard to learn a new language as an adult, whatever the reason for that may be. And it becomes arguably even more crucial and even more difficult when the languages that you're trying to pick up or learn are a tribal or ethnic dialect that isn't widely spoken, written, or passed down.
Hi everyone, I'm Sophia. I'm from a really small town in Wisconsin that's pretty close to Beloit, and currently I am a law student at the University of Marquette. I'm half Moroccan, half American. So growing up, me and my older brother grew up bilingual with English and French, my younger two siblings not so much, and honestly, two of my siblings just like don't have an interest in language, but I've always been somebody that is super interested in languages. So growing up, I knew English and French. And then in seventh grade, when we could start language in school, my school only had Spanish. So I started learning Spanish, took Spanish all through high school, did Spanish all throughout undergrad. I studied abroad in Spain. I taught in Mexico. And I was like, I am obsessed with Spanish. I love Spanish so much. And it's been amazing to speak Spanish. And like, it's so worthwhile, especially like in law school, because we do pro bono, which is just like free legal services. And so the clinic that I do my pro bono at, I speak Spanish like the whole time. And I don't know, I think language is like such an amazing connector. And it's been so amazing to know that there are so many other people that I can communicate with just because I took the time to really like invest in learning it. As far as like, especially like cultural languages, like I have always wished, like my whole life, I always wished I knew more Darija, which is Moroccan Arabic, like the dialect, because that's what my dad speaks. But it can be super hard because it's not technically like a written dialect, because there are so many like French and tribal language influences in it. So in a weird way, you like spell Darija words with 24 letter alphabet instead of the Arabic alphabet. And then we use like numbers and stuff. So I know like very basic Darija and like a lot of random things and random phrases and stuff. Like there are some things I can read, but it's also super difficult because it's not technically a written language. People write phonetically and everybody interprets phonetically as different. So like you could see the same word spelled three different ways and you just have to like figure it out. But not knowing Darija has been like kind of a sore spot in my life. So I like ask my dad how to say certain things. I just like Google the crap out of stuff. Like there have actually been like more blogs popping up that have a lot of Darija on them. So I've been like learning it that way, which has been super helpful. But yeah, my dad usually does like a weekly like Sunday morning call to family back home. My grandpa speaks French, so I can speak to my grandpa, but then there's another added layer of difficulty because all the communication with them has to be like through speaking. And as everybody uses WhatsApp, so it's just like sending like voice recordings back and forth. And then when I'm in France, I only speak French to my family usually, or unless my cousins speak English to me, but it's usually French.
Many people who can't speak their native languages, similar to Sophia and her experience with Darija, struggle to communicate with generations within their own families. And without that, it's really hard to pass down knowledge and cultural references between one another. Not to mention, many of our families are refugees or come from a background that involved a lot of trauma, making it even more inaccessible for them to share where they come from or what they've lived through.
My name is Victoria Lee. Ethnicity-wise, I'm Chinese, but born in the U.S., so proudly Chinese-American. I am based in Chicago, but I grew up in New York City in Flushing, which is a predominantly Chinese neighborhood there. I feel like as I got older, I had more of an appreciation to learn Chinese. When I was younger, I just viewed Chinese school as, why am I going to school? Extra day of school on Saturday. What am I doing here? And as I became older, I recognized the importance, especially because it was harder for me to communicate with my dad because he doesn't know English. So often I'd have to ask my mom to translate my English to Chinese for him to understand, or translate what he's saying in Chinese into English for me. And then just realizing it was hard for me to communicate with my grandparents because they, of course, don't know English. So when I went to Dartmouth, I studied Chinese. And because of that, I was able to improve my Chinese, feel a lot more confident, and also even be able to read and write a little bit. And now, I guess now that I'm in my adult life, so I'm 28, I just don't have many opportunities to practice Chinese. I don't live in New York anymore, so my family is there. So I don't have many opportunities to practice Chinese anymore. So I could now feel it declining. My skills are declining, which makes me wonder, when I have kids, how do I pass Chinese on to them? Because the Chinese level of fluency was native fluency for parents, drop to my level of fluency. Like, how much further is going to keep dropping to eventually, when hopefully not my kids, but future generations just don't know any Mandarin Chinese?
I'll jump in for a second. Growing up, Victoria's family owned a Chinese takeout restaurant in New York City, which added another layer to her story about watching her parents work long hours and the hardships that came with owning a business as a bilingual family. I asked Victoria if she could explain a bit more about how it felt to have such a massive language barrier between herself and her dad.
No, yeah, I think it's like two ways I think about it. Is like, one is the actual language barrier, but also two is the cultural barrier. And for the first one, the language barrier is just, we might not be able to communicate as clearly. I have to use my mom to translate between us. But also just like when I was younger, I don't think I saw him that often because he would work late at the restaurant. So we just didn't overlap too much in time. And I also think of times when, if I'm with him and we need to, like, I need to help translate for him. And sometimes I don't know what to say because I'm also young at that point. So one memory I remember is, we're going to Home Depot because he's very good at construction and building things and very handy. And he was pointing at a wooden beam and he was trying to say something about it. And he was just like, he, like H-E. But I know he's saying that because in Chinese, the word for like that, like he, she, it, they all sound the same as well. And so I just felt really embarrassed. And I also felt, just growing up, very embarrassed of my dad just wasn't as educated. He didn't really, I think, complete a middle school education because of the Cultural Revolution and communism in China. So I just like felt embarrassed because like, oh, he's just a restaurant worker, whereas other people's parents have college or graduate degrees or doing something that at least seems to my mind at that point more impressive. And then the other area, the cultural barrier in terms of communication, is because I think a lot of, maybe not to generalize, but at least what I observed from my dad is he definitely went through some trauma growing up in China during that time. And it was a hard time growing up in the Cultural Revolution. And he didn't really want to share about traditions or things he went through. And I had a project in college where I was researching something called Jiapu, where it would list your entire lineage for your family. And I want to ask him about that because my lineage would come from him, not my mom. And he didn't want to talk about it. And my mom had to explain to him and say, this is for her schoolwork. You need to talk about it. So there's like barriers in terms of language of, let's say we wanted to communicate, there was trouble. But then there's also barriers where he didn't want to communicate something because of cultural barriers.
Victoria's memory of her dad in Home Depot really, really breaks my heart. And I think the reason why is because it's relatable. Today, Victoria has unlearned those internalized feelings of resentment towards her parents, but man, they really get conditioned within us as kids growing up in the United States. As an adult now, though, it really, really does break my heart to think back on it and reflect on it. I mean, I remember once as a kid, I was walking home from school, and one of my friends had remarked how my mom has an accent. I don't remember exactly the context, but it was something like we were having a conversation and they jumped in and were like, "Oh, but your mom has an accent, right?" And I remember fighting to the death, trying to tell everyone that she doesn't. I was pretty easily set off when I was a kid, so I mean, like, I got in fights, and my friend even was mad confused as to why I cared so much if people knew that my mom had an accent. I think the whole embarrassing Indian accent thing was just so deeply ingrained into me that I was willing to just fight anyone about anything in order to deny it. But focusing back on what Victoria shared for a second about her dad's trauma and their language barrier, plus that additional cultural barrier causing a difficulty in them understanding one another, I've noticed this theme is present in a lot of our families. How many of our parents don't want to, or even can't talk about their life back home, or even who they are as people? I find in a lot of cases, immigrant kids barely feel like they know their parents, like really, truly know their story and who they are as people. And yet, in many cases, the intergenerational trauma between our parents' generation and ours still gets passed down anyway, even with the language barrier, even when we don't feel like we know our parents well. And this is actually something that Zamzam's work has researched.
Specifically thinking about my research, I'm sort of reviewing the research out there and looking at what other studies there are, how other studies think about intergenerational transmission of trauma and how that shows up in families. There is a lot of studies that say that language and communication is either a way to continue this transmission of trauma or to break the cycle. When you think about communication, if parents don't share their, you know, experiences, like what is their immigration story, if there's a disconnect between how parent and child or parent and young adults are able to engage in communication, it really does perpetuate this feeling of loss, this feeling of disconnect. Or, you know, depending on how the parent communicates with the child, if they slowly but very carefully disclose certain informations or experiences in a way that's not overwhelming for the child or the young adult, that communication can have healing. It can have deep understanding and empathy and compassion, but also like context for, okay, now I know why, you know, when mom sees a police car, like she's flips out, or like, now I know why, like, when mom is upset, like, her reaction is a little more than what is needed. It's because of so-and-so experience. Like, it allows us context so that we are more understanding. And so when you have understanding, then you have, you're not sort of judging. You're more curious than you're judging. And that allows for compassion. So depending on how our parents or how we sort of communicate with each other, that really either, you know, increases emotional connectivity or creates a disconnect. And unfortunately, there is a study by Dr. Cox and his team in Oklahoma State that talk about shared language erosion. And so this is when families, especially immigrant families, who all live together but have different language developments. So you have parents who their native language, they're really strong in that. And then you have children who, like when they're born, yes, they're really strong in the native language, but as they get older, English language becomes their primary language, whereas their parents' English language skills remain the same. So now you have a disconnect between the primary languages of the parent and the children, and to the point where actually, you know, some families use Google Translate to communicate with each other. And that's really difficult if you think about simple interactions having to go through Google Translate. How can you have a discussion about trauma and pain, or how can a child talk to their parent about you know, feeling bullied or feeling like higher level emotional interactions. Like that's really difficult to have when you don't have a shared language. And so, you know, communication is key, and it's really essential in learning how to communicate with people, which is, you know, as in therapy, that's what I'm trained to do, is communicating like with people, but also facilitating communication through people. I think communication is key to healing.
Using Google Translate to communicate with your family might seem like a rare and far-fetched example, and yet it's not. It's a reality for more people in this country and families than I think we realize.
Hi, my name is Annie Tan. I am based in Queens, New York, and I am Chinese American. I speak English. English is the only language I'm fluent in. But I also speak Toisanese, Mandarin, and Cantonese at differing levels, but all around elementary fluency. So I sound like a kid when I'm speaking. I was born here in America, and my parents are Chinese immigrants from the southern region of China, where they speak Cantonese and Toisan. I was forced to go to Mandarin Chinese school as a kid, but Mandarin, Cantonese, and Toisan are three different dialects that are different from each other, you know, mutually unintelligible, I should say. And they are tonal languages. So if you say say instead of say, that's the number four. And say is the word for death. Say, say. And so it was really hard for me to pick up the tones as a kid. My mom and dad were interchanged between Cantonese and Toisan all the time, so I'm not fluent in the languages that my parents speak, and they don't speak English. And so growing up here in Chinatown in Manhattan, that meant that I now can't speak with my parents fluently. And I also learned Spanish in middle school because that was the only language my middle school 131 offered. So I can read and write and speak and listen more in Spanish than I can even in Cantonese, because Chinese characters aren't phonetic, which makes me very sad. I've taught in Little Village in Chicago and then in Sunset Park in Brooklyn, where I've spoken with both Spanish-speaking parents and Chinese-speaking parents in Cantonese, Toisan, and Mandarin. And it's been useful. And ever since smartphones came out with dictionaries, I can start using Cantonese language dictionaries to speak more with my parents. But it's a very belabored process and very, very frustrating. And so I'm actually writing a memoir on this right now. I've been working on it for you know, seriously, for about 3 years now. I've been telling stories about this for 7 years, and I'm almost done with the first draft. It has been so difficult explaining the intricacies of all these languages, and it makes me very sad to have, you know, what some people call racial melancholia, but also kind of like a language melancholia that I will never fully be able to speak with my parents. And I probably need a translator in order to get their stories and their history so that I can know my own history. And outside of me going and living in the Toisan province in China, which isn't going to happen for a while because of COVID precautions and other things, this is my middle ground. And hopefully if and when I have a kid one day, I will have my parents, you know, help raise that kid. And hopefully that kid can still pick up some of my parents' language. But if not, you know, they're only going to speak English and not be able to connect with their grandparents. And so it is a big mix of things. It is very sad. And I wish I could speak Cantonese or Toisan fluently, but it is what it is. There's only so much I can do with my language.
For a lot of people, there is the acceptance that the generation that follows them just isn't going to know all their native languages. And that's so real to me, because I feel that fear too. I really, really associate my languages with a feeling of home. Often, it's not even a physical place, it's just the sound of someone speaking Gujarati or Hindi or Urdu. Even when people speak other non-South Asian languages, something about hearing them in their native tongue just feels like home to me. For some people, the idea of language being a form of home is deeper than just a feeling. It's a recorded historical event. More specifically, when it comes to countries like Bangladesh, the people have an inextricable link between their mother tongue and their national or ethnic identity. So, as one can imagine, losing that tongue holds a lot of weight.
Hi, my name is Marzia Chowdhury. I wanted to jump on this opportunity to talk about my native language, which is Bangla. I was born in Bangladesh, but I grew up in the States. My family always emphasized speaking our native language, which for me was the dialect I spoke in my hometown back in Bangladesh. But then I got married eventually, and then my husband is a native Bangla speaker from Bangladesh, and so he and I spoke it, you know, in our home, and now I'm pretty fluent at it. And our first child is actually due in 2 weeks, so we're planning on teaching it to him as well in our home, like speaking it at home, so he has a full grasp of it as he's growing up and not like having to later learn it in life. But yeah, definitely important since our country did fight a liberation war to be able to keep speaking Bangla. And it's so important to keep it going because I'm afraid in the next few generations we will lose the ability to speak Bangla altogether if we don't.
Hi, I'm Farzana and I was born in Bangladesh but moved to New York City when I was less than a year old. Bangla, also known internationally as Bengali, was my first language. I spoke English easily, but because of my accent, I was put into ESL, English as a second language. My parents didn't want me to get confused at school, so they started speaking English at home, and I quickly lost fluency. I can still understand a bit, but it's the worst in my family. Even my four-year-old cousins are more proficient than me, switching to English when they talk to me. My feelings got even more complicated when I learned about Bangladesh's history.
A little over 50 years ago, in 1971, a war broke out that changed the history of South Asia. Prior to 1971, after the British left South Asia and partitioned the subcontinent, there existed two portions of Pakistan. First was West Pakistan, the Pakistan we know of today. Then, on the opposite side of the subcontinent was East Pakistan, modern-day Bangladesh, a disjointed region of Pakistan miles apart, nestled around the start of the Ganges River. There were a number of discrepancies between East Pakistan and West Pakistan, including economic disparities, martial law, and a general condescension towards Bengali people and culture by the ruling group of West Pakistan towards the East. But the one most visceral issue of the two parts was that of language. The ruling party of West Pakistan refused to acknowledge Bengali as a state language of East Pakistan and attempted to pressure Bengalis to speak Urdu instead. The people refused to give up their mother tongue. Protests broke out in universities and all across the country. And so, Bangladesh became the first country in the world to fight a civil war for their mother language. The war lasted 9 months and somewhere between 300,000 and 3 million people died. The official death toll remains unsorted. Finally, the Pakistani troops retreated and the country of Bangladesh was born. And with it was also a second mass migration of Bengalis to and from India and Bangladesh. With each border drawn, more and more South Asian blood was shed. As with nearly all South Asian countries, the start to Bangladesh's history was a bittersweet one, as many lives and family histories were lost in the process of partition. Bangladeshis had to fight tooth and nail in order to protect their civil liberties and their language, and the memory of that does not go forgotten. Many Bangladeshis, such as Marizia, who we heard from earlier, have made it a point to pass down both their story and their language, with the cognition of what their people have had to go through and give up in order for them to have the freedom to speak their mother tongue. As for Farzana, She knows the toll of this all too well, as during the Bangladeshi Liberation War, her uncle was even kept as a prisoner of war.
It makes me feel really guilty and embarrassed because how important this language is. People fought for it, people died for it, and I just lost touch of it when I was really young in the process of becoming more Americanized. And while I'm still very proud of my Bengali heritage, not being fluent has made me feel a lot more disconnected from it. Even when I try speaking with my family sometimes, it's pretty broken, and while they try to be encouraging, it does come off a little condescending when they're like, oh my god, you're trying to speak Bangla, so cute, and it just feels bad as a grown adult not having that type of proficiency or connection to my culture. And I'm really worried about when I have kids, what I'm going to be able to pass on to them. My parents as immigrants were able to pass on a lot to me, and even though I'll still have some of it to tell my kids, it isn't the same. But yeah, I'm still hopeful that as I age, I'll have more opportunities to reconnect with my culture. And even if I don't ever become fluent in Bengali, there's still a lot of great English translations for a lot of the art and literature. And I could still, even if there's not a Duolingo class, speak it more with my family in order to get a little bit closer to the culture and a little bit closer to the language.
I think it's really easy to be hard on ourselves for not being able to speak our native language, whether you speak it in a broken way or even not at all. And as Farzana referenced, there's always other chances for us to connect with our native cultures. There's even folks at Duolingo, like Emad Ali Akbar, who we heard from in the part one of this episode, who hosts Duolingo's Radiolingo podcast, and he's still in the process of figuring out how to hold on to his mother tongue. So I guess you can say it happens to the best of us.
Hello, everyone. My name is Thomas Sulavong, and I wanted to share a little bit about what it means to me to be a Lao Chinese American who doesn't know how to speak Lao and knows how to speak Mandarin Chinese. To give everyone a little bit about my background, I'm one quarter Lao and three quarters Chinese. I was born and raised in Missouri. The simple reason why I don't know how to speak Lao and know how to speak Mandarin Chinese is because both sides of my family emphasize the Chinese part of my identity more than the Lao side. As for the Lao side of my family, my dad's side, the older generation didn't want to pass anything Lao related down to my generation, and that also included the language. The only time I would hear the older generation speak Lao is when they would switch languages to avoid saying something they didn't want us, the younger generation, to hear. I didn't think much about not being able to speak Lao as a kid, since I didn't have any interest in wanting to be Lao. I have some cousins who, to this day, don't speak any sort of quote-unquote Asian language, such as Lao or Mandarin Chinese, and don't care at all about anything Asian-related. With that aside, I adhered to my family's wishes of emphasizing being Chinese over being Lao until I got to college. That was when I first got interested in learning more about the Lao side of my identity and interacting with Lao people. As of now, it pains me to say that I still don't know how to speak Lao, even though I wish I could learn. It's unfortunate that I have less time as I grow older, lack people who can speak to me in Lao on a daily basis, and don't have many media that can assist in learning. Learning Lao beyond my basic knowledge is a challenge.
What Tommy's talking about is actually represented within Zamzam's work and even through her own experiences. She shared a bit about her experience of struggling to translate between English and Somali. She also explained how language is deeply attached to our identity and what that means for us.
It's funny because I tried to actually interpret. I was in a therapy session with a co-therapist. And so the client was Somali, and so she wanted me to interpret. And that was the most difficult conversation I've ever had in my life. It's just really hard to take words or sort of ideologies from therapy and then to apply that to a new language. It was just really difficult. And but I mean, and she was like, and I was struggling through it, and you know, we got through it together, and she knew what I was saying. But it definitely is like language is so attached to identity and who you are. And so I have a lot of clients who don't speak their ethnic language, and they don't feel like strongly attached to their ethnic identity as they would like to, which is pretty hard because it's really not their fault. The majority culture here speaks English, and so it's only natural that that's the language that you are stronger in. I think I'm really fortunate. I'm definitely fluent in Somali, but I'm more stronger in English, especially because like being in graduate school and having, you know, academic and research writing and all of those I feel like English is stronger for me. But I would, if I ever had kids, I would probably want them to maintain their Somali language, whatever that looks like. In my research, I asked the participants a question about like, well, what advice would you give the next generations after you? And everybody, like 1.5 and second generation, were like, hold on to your culture, maintain whatever you can from your culture, because that's a part of you, that's a part of your way of living. And, you know, I get nervous sometimes because I know, like, after the third generation, the language erasure happens. Like, there isn't a lot of, like, one of my participants called it their loss of uniqueness. And I know that unless you're very intentional early on to help, you know, your children maintain this language, it's very easy to lose. And so, you know, I get impressed sometimes when I see people who have, you know, parents who speak Japanese and Korean, and they only speak to one parent using one language, and they speak to the other parent in the other language. Like, that's a really smart thing to do. And I think that's something that I would definitely want for my child. And just having that intentionality around, like, holding on to language is just as important as holding on to religion or something else of that nature.
Hi, Needy. Sorry I took forever in getting this out to you, but I'm super excited to share because part of being Filipino, my language is a big part of my identity, because in the Philippines, there's over 120 languages spoken throughout all the islands. And my family, we speak like 3 different languages just inside my family, but mostly we speak a language called Bisaya. It's a language spoken in the islands of Visayas, and it's a really big part of my identity because not only am I Filipino and understand Tagalog, but I am part of a smaller subgroup, and I feel like it makes me really unique because not everybody understands Visayas, and it has a lot of components of the Spanish language, so I feel like it gives me a leg up when I'm learning Spanish as well. And as a mother, I have a lot of fears about passing on this unique identity I have to my daughter, because most Filipinos here in the U.S. they speak Tagalog just as a, you know, as a general language. If you're Filipino, that's going to be the main language that you're speaking. So I am definitely worried about passing on this part of me to my daughter, mostly because I only understand it and I don't really speak much Bisaya. My parents, they speak mostly Bisaya at home. It's just that, you know, she won't learn it in school. And if we were ever to put her in Filipino classes or something like that, they wouldn't be teaching this subgroup language. They would most likely be teaching Tagalog in the first place. So I definitely do have a lot of fears about this part of our family, my heritage, continuing on, especially in the United States.
As someone who speaks less Hindi, which is the most commonly spoken language in India, and is fluent in Gujarati, which is a state or tribal language with a dozen different dialects, I kind of get where Sam is coming from when she mentions struggling with a subgroup of language. And I'm fortunate, because even though Gujarati is a lesser known language than maybe Hindi, it still has millions of speakers worldwide. The language's survival and my family's presence within it isn't just gonna go extinct even if I stop speaking it. But specifically for tribal languages and dialects, as we're going to hear from Zamzam in a minute, it is really hard to pass those down and keep those alive. And for some people, when you lose that language ability, you end up losing more than just your family's heritage and a certain skill set. You lose access to the tribe itself, with no one to teach that rare language later on. There's no way back in for you, nor for the generations that follow.
Just the nature of like Somalia and tribalism and how that we're already divided into tribes, tribes aren't always meant to divide. They're also meant to like identify like who is your family. But sometimes people use it as a way to isolate others. And I think, you know, it really depends on the person and how they see tribalism or tribes. But yeah, language, I'm not really, even if I wanted to access like my father's tribe, I don't know how to do that, right? A couple of years ago, actually, I had a phone call with my aunt, my dad's sister, and she doesn't speak standard Somali, and I don't speak the dialect, so we literally could not communicate with each other. And it was really sad because I've never interacted with her in my entire life, and this is the only opportunity that I had. She's like, she's older than 90 years old, so. And I couldn't really have a conversation with her at all. So I do think sometimes, you know, people get made fun of for not having that language, especially the diaspora. We have certain nicknames for different generations, at least in the Somali culture, for people who can't speak Somali properly. And that just further pushes people away from learning the language or trying to use it, because the only way that you can maintain a language is to use it, and the only way to use it is to make mistakes. But if you get, you know, picked on or made fun of for making those mistakes, that further pushes you from your motivation to learn the language.
My name is Stephanie Bachwe, and I am from Ghana, West Africa. My parents are from there, so I grew up in the United States. I grew up right outside of DC, about 25 miles outside in a suburb called Gaithersburg, which is known to be one of the most diverse cities in America. Growing up with, you know, immigrant parents is very different because, you know, they're still trying to adjust to life themselves as an adult and raise kids in two different cultures and against things they maybe don't believe in per se. So in Ghana, they're different tribes. My mom is an Ewe, my dad is a Ga. The Ewe speak Ewe, the Ga speak Ga, and then everybody for the most part speaks Chui. But my dad doesn't really speak Chui that well. My mom speaks Ga, Ewe, and Chui. My grandma only speaks Ewe, and then my aunt only speaks Ewe and Chui. So growing up, it was just a mix of languages going on all the time. And I remember, I don't speak it that well. I don't. Because my parents only spoke English with us. And I remember they were saying that there was a time that my older brother had went to school and he had to go to speech class. Like, they thought he was special ed because, you know, when kids aren't speaking at a certain age, you know, it raises a lot of red flags and a lot of alarms. So they were like, you guys need to stop speaking a bunch of languages around your kids. And it's like, now that I look back on it, I really think there was a way around that, because there are tons of kids that literally speak 9 languages and they're fine. I just feel like it was just the Americanized thing to do, because a lot of parents come here and they try so, so, so hard to assimilate. Like, I remember on Sundays we would go to church. My mom would be wearing her traditional African clothes. My aunt and my mom didn't even want to go to the store dressed in their clothes. Like, they would go home, they would change, and then they would go out. Same thing with speaking Ga or Ewe or Chui or whatever it was in front of people. It was like they were just trying so hard to assimilate to being American, because think about it. Growing up at that time, anything that was foreign, people were like, well, what is going on? Like, why are you speaking another language in front of people? You know, I feel like things have been a bit more tolerable now. But growing up, 15 years ago, 16 years ago, things were just not like that at all. Language is just important to family and everyone who it involves, because it's a sense of identity. It's nice to be able to go back to your home country and you can speak the tongue. You're not a foreigner. Even so, I always tell my mom, like, I speak French very well, and my family doesn't speak French. My parents learned French in school because, you know, Ghana is neighboring two French-speaking countries, and we were colonized by the English, so we speak English. I learned it in school very well, picked it up very fast. I feel like the same would be for Ga'ewe and Chui if I sat down in a classroom, because I've heard it all my life, right? I at least understand some of it. I've been hearing it all my life. I've heard people speak it all my life. If I was to go, a story I always tell people, when I went to Amsterdam, I was in Schiphol Airport, and I'm seeing, this was like the first time I had ever seen mass, like, black immigration, like, working. So I was walking through Schiphol Airport. I'm seeing all the cleaning ladies are black. I'm like, what is going on in here? And they're all speaking Chui to each other. And I'm like, they're all Ghanaian. I call my mom. I'm like, Ghana, my understanding is for the most part, Ghanaians immigrate only to the UK and to the US. So I'm like, I'm in Amsterdam. I'm like, the Netherlands, there's Ghanaians. So she's like, oh yeah, there's plenty, plenty. They just make them go and they clean offices and it shattered my heart. But again, I wouldn't have known they were Ghanaian if I didn't hear my native tongue, right? So language is important. Culture is important. I think everybody needs to sit down and take the time to know their native tongue, because there's a lot of kids like me who they've heard it their whole life, but they don't per se speak it that well. But if they were to sit down in a classroom setting, they'd pick it up, you know? So that's just my bit on it. Thank you so much for inviting me here today, Needy. You're great. What you're doing is great. And a lot of these stories need to be told.
A very special thank you to Steffi for sharing that story. I was really moved while listening to it, and I really appreciate her sharing it. I remember, and I know how stereotypical this sounds, but I remember all my life walking into coffee shops like Dunkin' Donuts or fast food places like White Castle and just hearing Gujarati being the only language spoken by the people working there. In fact, when I was a teenager, I worked briefly at Dunkin' Donuts. I know, very stereotypical. Most of the workers there were Gujarati, though some were not. And there was this one older woman in particular, around our grandparents' age, working there at the time. She was super kind and would always give me free donuts, and she barely spoke any English. So those of us who knew Gujarati would speak to her in Gujarati, not because we wanted to, but because if we didn't, she simply wouldn't understand us. I remember it really broke my heart to see her working at this fast food place at that age, and sometimes seeing the customers or other staff have like a lack of patience with her if she didn't understand something, that was really frustrating for me. And as someone who worked the morning shift at 4 a.m., I can tell you this. There are few people ruder in this world than white suburban customers speaking to immigrant fast food workers. I remember one instance as I was working and a non-brown coworker came up to me and began complaining about how the workers were speaking Gujarati. I suppose she felt it was okay to say those things to me and even thought that she'd garner my support because of my clean American accent. But I am Gujarati. I speak Gujarati. Gujarati is my native tongue, and I did not agree with her. Lo and behold, a few days later, we were told not to speak our mother tongue in the workplace. I still think it's kind of crazy how obsessed people are with how they're being perceived and assuming that just because somebody is speaking a different language that they're being gossiped about. It's a similar theme that I see about Southeast Asian people working in nail salons and the customers who go there and complain about them speaking their native tongue. Perhaps it's a part of American individualism that we think everything is about us, but truly, they are placing their own self-importance above access and resources for people who otherwise just might not be able to understand. Language is an important part of life, of culture, and of identity. I, as a podcaster, am hyper aware of this. I mean, language is how I connect with you all. Practically none of you have seen my face, have you? You shouldn't have. But you don't have to, do you? You know my voice, you know the way I talk, and that is how you all know me. This episode has covered a lot of languages, cultures, ethnicities, and people. It spanned generations, from parents to children to grandchildren of diaspora folks. It's a bittersweet one, stories of people who have lost or are actively losing their mother tongues. But one thing that is undeniable about every clip sent in is that it's an example of how your voice carries more than just a language. It carries your story. And by sharing a voice note, people also shared their family's histories with all of us. As I've learned growing up in the United States my whole life, and as many of our ancestors probably knew very well after living through colonization by Western nations, there's more ways to connect to your culture than just through your native language. Your culture is something that is within you. Whether we're loving or losing our languages, we remain as a part of something bigger, writing our people's histories through our actions and in whatever script we choose, one story at a time. And that's it for this two-part episode on loving and losing our tongues. That was a long one, guys, so thank you, Shukriya, for sticking around. I am so grateful for those who took the time to send in voice notes. Shukriya to Abhinav Das, Shukriyaitis, Sophia Fell, Victoria Lee, Annie Tan, Tommy Suravong, Marizia Chowdhury, Farzana Huck, Samantha Reyes, Stephanie Botchway, and Zamzam Dini. If you like what you heard, please hit that follow button on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you're listening on. Also, give this episode a share with somebody you know. Remember to give us a follow on our socials. Both Instagram and Facebook are under the same name as this podcast, Mono Minority Uniquely American. Mono Minority is written, created, and produced by yours truly, Nidhi Shastri. All of our music comes from the Creative Commons, so a thank you to the artists there. And as always, Shukriya, thank you for listening, and until next time.